Yes, I'd also like to start by thanking the organizers for the invitation. And this will be an optics talk. I will try to tell you about a single quantum dot, single photon turnstile device, too many singles. So this is the device that I'm going to describe to you has unique signatures in what we refer to in quantum optics as photon correlation measurements or intensity correlation measurements. So I will start my talk by going over what these measurements measure, what kind of interesting physics we can expect to see in these measurements. Again, this is considering that the majority of the audience do not have a background in quantum optics. Then I will describe to you how the single photon source, this single photon turnstile device, I will use these terms interchangeably, works. And in the last part, I will tell you what happens when we tune a quantum dot into resonance with the cavity mode in which these quantum dots live. And in that case, we can see the so-called Purcell effect, that is the enhancement of the radiative decay rate by coupling to a cavity mode. And this is, as I will try to argue, is an important factor in making a useful single photon source. So here's a list of my co-workers. This is a collaboration between my group and those of Evelyn Hu and our chairman, Pierre Petrov. And the actual experiments are done by the graduate students, Alper Kiraz, Chuck Rees, and the postdocs that are listed here. Some of them former postdocs, I must say. So let me start by trying to argue why photon sources are, single photon sources are interesting. Why do we want to make them? And again, in our case, and I think for the majority of experimentalists trying to realize such sources, the primary motivation comes from quantum information processing. And the first motivation, the first application of single photon sources is in quantum cryptography. This has been known for 16, 17 years, since I think 1984, that if you have a single photon source, that is optical pulses that never contain more than one photon, then you can have unconditional security in key distribution between two parties that want to communicate secretly. Now, a more recent motivation or application of single photons was basically proposed within the last year, appeared earlier this year in Nature, where Manik Nil, Ray LaFlamme, and Jared Milburn have shown that if you have access to single photons, then you can realize efficient quantum computation using only linear optical elements and photodetection. Now, I think this is really a remarkable discovery in some sense. I'm not sure if it's really the answer to scalable quantum computation, but certainly these elements, especially with the recent developments in single photon sources, are things that we have in the lab. So it's basically now a matter of putting together known technology. Maybe it's that's a little oversimplification, but I think it definitely does provide a serious alternative or challenger to small-scale quantum information processing. Now, the experiments on quantum cryptography have been going on for a few years, certainly precedes the single photon source experiments. And what those experiments have been using to mimic single photon sources are either highly attenuated laser pulses, that is, you start with a laser pulse that typically contains, say, 10 to the 10 photons, you attenuate it like mad, such that the average number of photons becomes on the order of unity. Well, actually, if it's unity, then it's no good because of the Poisson fluctuations. Laser light is a quasi-classical light. If you have an average number of photons that is equal to unity, that means that you have a good chance that you will have two, three, or even four photons in a pulse, and that's no good for the security. So what they do in these experiments is that attenuate it further, go to mean photon numbers that are typically 0.1 or 0.01, such that most of the pulses are empty, but then the likelihood of a pulse containing two photons is basically negligible. Another avenue is to use parametric down conversion, where a parent photon is converted into two daughter photons in a nonlinear crystal. And these photons can be emitted into different modes. And in that case, since every photon conversion results in two photons, if you detect a photon in one arm in one mode, then you'll be guaranteed to have a photon in the other arm. And therefore, by this post-selection, you can prepare a single photon source or a single photon pulse. The problem here is random generation. The process of this conversion, nonlinear conversion, is random. So if you want to have an access to a photon on demand, this is not the type of source you want. Anyway, a solution to this was proposed by myself and Yoshi Yamamoto back in 1994. And this, I bring this up because this really borrowed heavily from the mesoscopic physics community, where we suggested that one can use Coulomb blockade effect for electrons and holes in a PIN junction, a mesoscopic PIN junction, to regulate the single photon, so to regulate generation events and generate single photon pulses that are separated by a deterministic dwell time. Now, this in retrospect is really a difficult proposal, but elements of it have already been realized by Yoshi Yamamoto and his student, or former student, Jungsan Kim, who showed that there indeed the light generated by this device, by such a device, can be non-classical. More sort of simpler and to the point experiments were done in using single molecules. And the most exciting one probably is the one reported last year by Murner and Luinis. And this one is a really or relatively simple experiment where you have a single molecule embedded in a matrix, and this operates at room temperature. It's not an ideal source. There is 20% chance that the pulse contains two photons due to the background, not due to two photon generation from the single molecule, but because of the background that the system is embedded in. So what I'm going to tell you about is a single photon source based on a single self-assembled indium arsenide quantum dot. And this can be embedded in a microcavity. And the disadvantage as compared to, say, a single molecule source is that this has to be done at cryogenic temperatures. But at 4 Kelvin is definitely sufficient. So you don't have to go to dilution fridges. And one of the advantages is that we were able to basically get rid of the background radiation completely, and there are also significant differences as to what kind of single photon pulse you generate. And this becomes important, especially in the second application, and if I have time, I will come back to that later. So, as I mentioned to you earlier, these single photon sources, the question is, how do you understand or how do you know that you have realized a single photon source? And the answer to that, as I already heralded, is that you look for the intensity correlation function. That is this normally ordered correlation between the intensity of the generated source. And so what I'm going to do now is first show you how you can make such measurements. It's a relatively simple experimental setup, and then I'll tell you about again, some basic physics which we can learn from these measurements. So this is called a Hanbury, Brown, and Twist setup in quantum optics, named after people who first used such a setup to show that photons from a thermal light source are bunched. And I will come to that later. So in our case, what we do is we look at luminescence coming out of a quantum dot living in a cryostat. We filter any sort of back-reflected laser light and divide the luminescence, the quantum dot luminescence, into two arms, using a 50-50 beam splitter, and send them to avalanche photodiodes. So these photodiodes generate voltage pulses upon detecting a single photon, and the rise time of these pulses are on the order of 300 picoseconds. So what then we do is send these voltage pulses onto electronics, so-called time-to-amplitude converter. One of the APDs, avalanche photodiodes, or the pulses generated from that, act as a start pulse for the electronics. So it basically triggers the electronics, which then waits for the second pulse coming from the so-called stop avalanche photodiode. And in this way, the electronics records the waiting time between two successive photon emission events. And then you basically average over many such events and obtain this waiting time distribution, which under limits of our experiment directly gives us the intensity correlation function. Okay, so after the initial experiment using thermal light, one of the major results in quantum optics was obtained in 1970s using a single atom as the source of radiation. And the phenomenon observed
is...
What
do you see from this correlation function that this is one single photon source?
I'm going to come to that. So I'm trying to go slowly. I want to describe what happens if you have a single quantum emitter first. Okay, so this hopefully will justify why you would want to use a single quantum dot or a single molecule. Otherwise, the system or the single photon source will not work properly. Anyway, so what I want to discuss first is what happens if you have a single two-level system like an atom, which is, of course, the system used in these experiments by Jeff Kimball and Leonid Mandel in 1976. And what you do is you use CW excitation mechanism, say a laser, to excite the atoms to an excited state and look for the luminescence. So the spontaneous emission generates the radiation that you're going to do your intensity correlation measurements on. And so if you think about what happens in the system, if you detect the photon at time tau equals zero, then we know that the end result of that measurement process has to be that the atom ends up in the ground state. And since the ground state is non-emissive, we then know that emission of another photon by this system is impossible if we just look at photon emission events immediately after the first one. So in this sense, two photons never come right after each other because you have a single emitter and the fact that emission results in the projection of the atomic wave function onto the ground state. And this is what we refer to as photon anti-bunching. And the signature of it in the ideal case is that the zero time delay intensity correlation simply vanishes. Now, what you expect to see in intensity correlation function then is, again, for zero time delay, it vanishes. And in a time scale, a recovery time scale, ultimately determined by the recombination time or the lifetime of the excited state, this recovers into some steady state value where the emission probability basically is recovers its steady state value, meaning that the emission becomes essentially a random process. Okay. Now, why is this interesting? It seems like a rather simple physical effect. It's interesting because if you just regard this, forget about the source, and if you just try to explain the statistics, the electromagnetic field statistics, by treating this as an electromagnetic field, then what you would find is that you cannot explain such an effect using classical Maxwell fields. You have to quantize the electromagnetic field in order to account for such anti-bunching effects. The other aspect is that you can argue that, you can easily see that if you have two or more such two-level systems, then detection of a single photon will never tell you that the complete system is in the ground state. It might just very well be that the second atom is in the excited state, and therefore a second emission event can indeed take place. So if you have two or more two-level systems, then the value of G2 of zero, intensity correlation, will never go below 0.5. So if you see an intensity correlation below 0.5, then you can argue that this is a direct proof or indication that what you are looking at is a single anharmonic quantum system. So you can use it to sort of find out about the system that you are looking at, such as the quantum dots. Okay, so what I want to highlight here is, after telling you about what happens in photon anti-bunching if you excite a single quantum emitter, what kind of a signature do we expect to see in a single photon source, in a triggered single photon source? And this is what I claim such a source should exhibit. So since we would like to have this deterministic dwell time between successive photons, the likelihood of detecting a photon at these deterministic times should be higher than the average. But since each pulse contains only one photon, the probability of having two photons immediately after should again be zero. So we should see this anti-bunching at zero time delay, just as we see here. But instead of some random emission at longer times, we should have these correlated emission where the emission probability or detection probability of a photon is higher than average at certain integer multiples of the period of our single photon source. So this is the kind of signature or the direct signature that I've been that I told you about before. Now, I've been telling you about the about what happens when you excite a single atom, and as you have noticed in my title, we are using a single quantum dot in our experiments. And the question that I would like to address is why not use a single atom and resort to an artificial atom, a quantum dot. And here is a list of reasons that I think are important. And the first one is probably the most important. And that is the fact that in most quantum dot systems, and definitely true for these self-assembled quantum dots, we have what I will call as a strongly trapped emitter. That is, if we find a quantum dot that we want to use as a source of single photons, and if you locate it on a certain place in our wafer, it's going to stay there forever. So we can rely on the fact that we can come back over and over again, and it will be there at that position, and we can excite it and use it to generate single photons. This is certainly not the case if you have an atom where even trapping times of on the order of a millisecond for a single atom is possible, but technologically very demanding. Now, quantum dots also provide strong coupling to radiation fields, and this is important for getting sort of fast and directional output from your single photon source. There is interesting physics here already, that the oscillator strength of a single quantum dot exciton transition can range between 10 to 300. And this is because we now are dealing with an extended object that has the size of, say, 20 to 30 nanometers, and that results in a collective enhancement of the optical transition probability, which results in these large oscillator strengths. And then, in the long run, although this is not something we are working on definitely at this point, you can also think about an electrical injection of carriers for realizing a more compact device. Interactions between the carriers that you generate in a quantum dot play a key role, and I will come to that in shortly. I mean, that's how you can obtain an anharmonic spectrum in this extended object that we refer to as quantum dot. Okay, so let me show you or briefly tell you about the self-assembled quantum dots that are grown in Pierre Petrov's group here. So basic idea is to use MBE and grow nice gallium arsenide layer, and on top of that, you try to grow indium arsenide, which has a lattice mismatch with gallium arsenide. And after one or two monolayers, these indium arsenide atom or indium and arsenide atoms decide that it's more energetically favorable to form islands rather than continue with the 2D growth mode. And islands are formed, which are shown here. This is data from the Würzburg group, which are randomly distributed over the sample surface, even though there is some anti-bunching in the sense that two quantum dots rarely, if ever, come right next to each other. And this is a high-density sample, which is not the case that in our samples. We're looking at about two orders of magnitude lower quantum dot density than what is shown here. Anyway, so after these islands form, they are covered again by growing gallium arsenide on top, and the net result is that you have these disc-shaped regions of indium arsenide, which has lower band gap energy than the surrounding gallium arsenide, which surrounds it basically on all three dimensions. And the carriers, both electrons and holes, can therefore be confined within the indium arsenide region. What we then do to characterize these systems is to look at photoluminescence. So this is, again, a really simple experiment. What we do is we take a laser field in the first part of the experiment. This is continuous wave. It generates electron and holes in the surrounding gallium arsenide region. And quantum dots act as nice local traps for these electrons and holes, since they provide the lowest possible energy levels that are available around. And therefore, the electrons and holes are captured. And this capture is amazingly fast, occurs basically within 100 picosecond time scale, in contrast to for earlier suggestions that there might be a phonon bottleneck effect due to the discretization of these energy levels, zero-dimensional density of states. Anyway, that doesn't happen. The carriers are captured, and then we look at luminescence from the system and try to identify the single exciton line, the lowest available optical transition between lowest available electron and hole energy states. And that's our source, the photoluminescent source that we will be looking at. And here is a sort of a typical spectrum taken out at intermediate and high pump power densities. This is to show sort of what kind of signatures you see, optical signatures you see in these quantum dots. At even lower pump powers that I don't have here, quantum dot starts to show itself up as a single peak, single resolution limited peak above the noise background. At intermediate densities, additional peaks appear. One of them has a more or less quadratic dependence on the intensity or the pump power, and is typically identified as the bi-exciton peak. And in most cases, it is redshifted in energy as compared to the exciton line. And I will describe what I mean by the bi-exciton in a few minutes. There are additional peaks which might be associated with emission from charged excitons, and I don't think I will have time to discuss that. But the main point that I would like to highlight here is that these features are sort of what you expect to see based on a simple atom-like picture. But as you go to high pump power densities, things really start to change. So at the low energy side, for example, in addition to what I've been referring to as a bi-exciton peak, there is emission coming from, emission coming from the quantum dot when there are two electrons and two holes in the lowest available state. So that's what a bi-exciton is, but that's not alone. It's basically there is a pedestal around that bi-exciton with the addition of new peaks, all on the low energy side. And this, I don't think a very clear explanation of this really exists. And this sort of, in my opinion, signals a departure from ideal artificial atom behavior. Okay, so once again, though, what we want to do is just to focus on this exciton line and do these photon correlation measurements that I've told you about already. So let me set this aside. So this is another quantum dot. This now the photoluminescence is plotted as a function of energy. And what we do, again, using a spectrometer or an interference filter, we just filter this guy out and use the Hambury-Brown twist setup. And what we see is indeed that the intensity correlations show a nice dip at zero time delay. The size changes as we change the excitation power. That's because the recovery time not only depends on the recombination time, but also how fast we pump the system. And actually, from this information, we can learn about the lifetime of the excitons. And what I would like to highlight here is that there is no background radiation in the system. And that's very important, as I try to argue, in single photon sources. So the fact that this dip goes all the way down to zero, especially when you take into account our finite time resolution, tells you that whatever the luminescence that we're looking at is really coming completely from the quantum dot. There is no other contribution from background defects or what have you to this emission. Okay, no questions. No, I haven't come to that. This is under continuous wave excitation, so we're not expecting to form peaks. So I will. That's my next topic. So how do I go from this anti-bunching to a single photon source? Okay, so there are a few things that we need to highlight here. And the first one is, in order to tell the system about the periodicity that we would like to have, we have to excite with a periodic pulsed laser. Okay, so this is provided by a mode-locked laser that that we will use to create these electron hole pairs. And we would like to use this, we would like to choose an intensity that is relatively strong such that at the end of each laser pulse, we generate a dense enough electron hole plasma in gallium arsenide that we will be more likely to capture several electron hole pairs in the quantum dot. Okay, so if you look at the energy level diagram of a quantum dot, this is another way of looking at it. We start from a ground state where all the electrons are in the ground state, in the valence band, no electrons in the conduction band. Then we can create an electron hole pair, again, this time by capturing an electron and hole. That's what I will call the single exciton levels. We can capture two electrons, two holes, that's the bi-exciton level, and three excitons, and so on. So we will have this whole ladder, which are almost separated by the transition energy of the quantum dot. Okay, the band gap energy, of course, renormalized by the quantum confinement effects. Now, the important factor that I want to point out in this first point is that we don't want a weak excitation where there is a good chance that the quantum dot is not excited. We would like to have a mean excitation number that is, say, larger than 5, so that even though excitation is random, the probability of having 0 or 1 excitation is basically negligibly 0. So we would like this system to be highly excited. Okay? And then we are going to use the fact that each one of these transition energies are different. Okay? They don't have to be larger than each other, but the main point is that each of these photon energies that are emitted as you go from a 3-exciton to 2-exciton manifold or 2-to-1 and so on are different, and the reason for that is at each stage you have a different charge configuration in your quantum dot, and the Coulomb interactions between these charges renormalize the photon energy, and that's the most well-known case of that is, of course, the bi-exciton shift that you see, that I've shown you already in quantum dots, but that is also known for quantum well structures. Now, what then happens is you first create this highly excited state. The exact excitation is not so important. The system relaxes down, and as it relaxes to its ground state, because it will, after a certain period, since the free carriers are gone, as it relaxes down to its ground state, it always has to emit this last photon at energy omega 1x. And we are going to filter out this energy using our interference filter, and therefore, after each excitation, we will be guaranteed to see this photon. So the actual number of photons emitted by the quantum dot will be random, but the number of photons emitted at this energy will be well-defined and will be unity. This is the main idea behind how to turn a quantum dot into a single photon source. Okay, so what we then do is just look for the signature that I told you about. We first look at the intensity correlation of the Thai sapphire laser that we use to excite the system. And what we see is that we still have peaks, of course. This is different than continuous wave excitation, because whenever you have a laser pulse, you're more likely to detect a photon. But the important thing to point out here is that at zero time delay, the peak is at least as high as any other peak, indicating the Poisson statistics that is inherent in the Thai sapphire laser. What happens when we look at the single exciton transition is the main result. That is, we still see these peaks at integer multiples of the period of our mode-locked laser, indicating this likelihood of detection at these well-defined times. The peak at tau equals zero is completely absent. And the fact that there is no peak here directly tells us that none of the pulses that we detect contains more than one photon. Okay. Now, having said that, I should also highlight here is that this is not a proof that each pulse contains one photon. In fact, it doesn't in this case, because of the fact that our efficiency is on the order of 10 to the minus 3. So we can only argue based on our approximate efficiency of the system and the number of detected photons and the way the system works to say that we have one photon per every pulse. The important point that one needs to highlight here, however, is that this is the point that is crucial for quantum cryptography, that no pulse contains more than two photons. And as we engineer our system, we will see how high an efficiency we can get out of the system. One important aspect here, though, one reason for this low efficiency of this system is the fact that our source is embedded inside semiconductor, a high refractive index semiconductor, which has an index of 3.5, which means that only a few percent of the photons ever make it out of this host material. One way to get around that is to couple the quantum dots into a cavity mode. And once you have a cavity mode, then if the coupling is strong enough, the quantum dot can decay by emitting a photon to the cavity, and then the photons escape from the cavity even if you don't want them to, and then you can increase your coupling efficiency to the outside world. By as much, you can increase it all the way up to unity, basically, in principle. So how do we go about that? How do we create a micro cavity that the quantum dots couple to? So the answer is in this layer, which I didn't tell you about. There is a aluminum gallium arsenide layer underneath gallium arsenide and the quantum dot layers. And this is not drawn to scale. This range is about 200 nanometers. This is about 1 micron. What we do is that we put a mask and use a mask of 1 micron to 4 microns, etch out everything that is not underneath this mask using wet etching in this case, and define mesas, and then come in with the selective etch that attacks aluminum so that this layer underneath the quantum dots is removed selectively. The end result is a micro disk structure that I show you. So this is one of our structures that has a diameter of 4.5 microns. This new processing technique developed by Bruno Gairal and Jean-Michel Gérard results in amazingly smooth surfaces and amazingly high quality factors for the cavity modes. What are the cavity modes here? They are basically defined by optical modes that are confined to the circumference. Okay, they're confined because of the total, they experience total internal reflection at each bounce of the surface. And we can identify them using high density quantum dot samples, not the ones, this is not one of the samples that I've been showing you, which basically form a continuum of emission due to inhomogeneous broadening. Maybe this is a bit confusing here, but, and then such a continuum of emission can couple to these cavity modes, and we can identify what kind of cavity modes we are looking at. But the main point is the quantum dots live inside this disk, and they can couple to these haiku cavity modes. Now, here is another quantum dot. The one that I've shown you was far away from any cavity mode, but here is another one, not as nicely luminescing as the previous one, but this one exciton line that we've been looking at lives rather close to one of these whispering gallery modes of this microdisk structure. And this energy difference can be changed by changing the temperature, because the cavity modes depend on temperature via the index, the dependence of index on temperature, whereas the exciton line depends on temperature, or exciton energy depends on temperature due to the dependence of band gap. Now, these are not identical, and as we change temperature, we can basically make these two guys cross, and whenever there is a crossing, we see an enhancement of luminescence. And what we also see is that the structure the structure of the peaks that we see change. Basically, they become much narrower, indicating that this time uncertainty, ultimately determined by the spontaneous emission lifetime of the exciton, has been shortened. Okay? There's also an additional peak here. Somehow, at these high temperatures, we seem to be coupling to background radiation, and the system is not working as ideally as it was before. But let me address in the last 2 minutes that I have what results in this reduction of lifetime. And that's what what is commonly referred to as the Purcell effect. So this is a schematic. Of course, our cavity doesn't look like this, but if you have a quantum dot living inside a cavity, then there are, in principle, two modes of decay for this quantum dot. The first one is, of course, the presence of cavity hardly modifies, especially such a cavity, hardly modifies the vacuum modes around the quantum dot. So it can still decay by spontaneous emission that is basically unaffected from full free space decay. But there is another mode where the quantum dot can couple to the cavity mode, and then the cavity can lose the photon via mirror losses. That's an additional decay mechanism which we can relate to this coupling coefficient and the cavity decay rate. Now, if this guy, this cavity-induced decay, exceeds the spontaneous emission decay, then we are in this regime of a large Purcell factor exceeding unity, meaning that we have induced this new decay mechanism. Quantum dot will be more likely to decay away by coupling to the cavity, and then the cavity will spit the photon out through its mirror losses. Okay, so this is the Purcell effect, and here is, I think, what the data I've shown you is an indication but not a proof of Purcell effect. Here is a proof using time-correlated single photon counting. So here we look at the time decay of a single photon emission as a function of time. And if the quantum dot is far away from a cavity resonance, we first see that there is basically no temperature dependence of the total decay time, not just radiative. Whereas if you look at a quantum dot that becomes resonant with the cavity mode, in this case at 31 Kelvin, 4 Kelvin and 48 Kelvin data agree, they give the same decay time. At 31 Kelvin, when we have resonance, the decay time is shortened by a factor of 2, directly proving that we have the Purcell effect. So I was going to tell you about alternative cavity structures, but now that I see 0 minutes, I will just stop here and thank you for your attention.
In the graphs of the correlation function G, which is called the peaks, which repeat the peaks of the self-pumping laser. Now, what about the G0? Was it below 0.5 because there was a lot of noise there?
You mean, are you referring to this wave graph? Yes. So, yes, I mean, this is basically zero within our noise limit. So 0.5 would be, I think it would be around here. I don't remember the exact value of 1 here, but yeah, it's not to scale.
When you have your cavity, then the exciton is strongly coupled to the electromagnetic mode in the cavity, so it's kind of like a laboratory or whatever. But can you still identify it ambiguously with pi exciton? Because I think everything changes, like lifetimes and maybe the whole thing.
Good point. Actually, unfortunately, the answer to your question is no. We're not in a regime. We don't think we are in a regime where our quantum dot strongly couples to the cavity mode, so that it forms some sort of a polariton or dress state. That's actually one of our principal goals that we are working on. But for this system, the cavity mode is lousy enough. It's not one of our cavity modes. Of course, so far we've been relying on these accidental coincidences between quantum dots and cavity modes. This one is certainly not one of the best cavity modes we have, and because of this low Q value, we're not in a regime, which I didn't have time to discuss here, of strong coupling, where the cavity quantum dot coupling exceeds not only the spontaneous emission or the dephasing rate, but also the cavity decay rate. In fact, in our case, this is at least a factor of 10 larger than our cavity coupling. So the only effect of this cavity mode in this limit is that it provides this additional decay channel rather than redefines the eigenstates of the system, defining it.
What is the last slide? You showed that the peaks become narrower at the cavity. I think that was a slight small peak at zero.
Yeah, I tried to argue for that. I was rushing through it. I think, I mean, that's certainly, there could be two reasons for this. And one would be that our decay has become so short that the exciton decay has become so short due to Purcell effect that there is time for re-exciting the quantum dot before the carriers are gone. We don't think this, we're pretty sure this is not the case because we already also have a bi-exciton waiting time which is not affected by the cavity mode. So there is still a relatively large uncertainty on the order of nanoseconds in which comes from the fact that bi-exciton decay is not instantaneous. And the reason why we think this is happening is because of the probably at these higher temperatures we can excite some background carriers. We really don't understand what contributes to background, but there is definitely a background emission in these systems which comes prominent at high pump intensities and at higher temperatures. So it's a background radiation that is not correlated or directly correlated to quantum dot. Well, the fact that it's there shows that it's not directly related to the quantum dot. But we don't know the exact reason. That, I guess, is the short answer.
Does it mean that a single photon source can be created only by periodic pumping?
It doesn't have to be. I mean, it depends on the application. You can just send in one pulse and generate one photon. Basically, I think it would be nice if you have these sequence of pulses and you can just use your electro-optics to tap into one, use one, and just rely on the fact that there will be one at a certain time that is available. So, the answer actually is no, it can be generated by a single pulse, of course. So this is a triggered single photon source. Or a periodic single photon source, if you will.
Have you looked at what happened to the emission of the bi-exciton?
We did. That actually is interesting in its own right, not maybe directly related to the exciton or single photon source, but we have basically used these photon correlation measurements, and thank you for asking the question, to basically understand more about these quantum dots and especially the bi-exciton line. So this is yet another quantum dot where we have the photon correlation measurements. This is the exciton-exciton correlation, which is what I've been showing you. If you look at bi-exciton-bi-exciton correlation, or what you would refer to as a bi-exciton, then you see interesting structure that there is anti-bunching, it's not perfect, and there is also bunching effect around that anti-bunching. And we have other data where this bunching is very strong. And this is actually, again, can be explained by the ideas from quantum measurements. Basically, if you have a low pumped system where the excitation probability is low, then, and if you see a bi-exciton emission in this system, you suddenly create a final state where the quantum dot is in this excited state, this one exciton state, which I had up here. And from that single exciton state, it is easier to go up to a bi-exciton state, which means that, therefore, that the likelihood of seeing a second bi-exciton emission event can be enhanced. And this curve shows the cross correlation. Basically, if you see a exciton event here, then seeing a bi-exciton event afterwards is very unlikely. But if you can turn it around, if you see a bi-exciton event here, then this the observation of an exciton emission becomes suddenly very likely, and that this arises from the sort of sequential emission that you would expect from this bi-exciton-exciton system.
Could there be some rule for this correlation?
Some rule, certainly this correlation ideally should just shoot up. I mean, if the system were ideal, whenever you see a bi-exciton decay, that should be I think infinitely high. I'm not sure if there is some rule. There might be, but I'm not sure.